the genesis of this was actually my sister-in-law, another double-barreled name, Jenny Silverthorne Wright, and she met Merlin at FarmEd in the UK. So she got a copy of his book and sent it to me, knowing that Manx Wildlife Trust were doing a lot of work in the area of restoring temperate rainforest in the island. And I just found the book amazing. It's such a personal story of Merlin's. It brings a lot in about his personal tragedy, his background in the army. And for me, what was really interesting was the real healing nature of the temperate rainforest that he was restoring. And I'll let him tell a bit more about that. But I just felt it would be great for our audience in the Isle of Man, with the work that we're doing around restoring temperate rainforest, to have Merlin come over and speak to our members.
So give us a bit of your background then, Merlin, because Graham's hinted at it, but just sort of give us a bit about your background and how you came into the work that you're now doing.
Oh, thank you. And thank you, Graham, for that lovely introduction. And I'm back at FarmEd next week, which I'm looking forward to, again, around the book. So it's been a wonderful venue for me. So exactly as Graham mentioned, so my background was in the military. I did the first 8 years of my career in the British Army and did 3 tours in Afghanistan. And in my first tour, I was blown up by a roadside bomb by the Taliban, and was very lucky that both I and my crew in the vehicle survived. But it was about 10 years after that I had a mental health breakdown and started to suffer from quite bad complex PTSD. And I'm very lucky that I grew up on a farm on Bodmin Moor in Cornwall, and that in the heart of this farm, we have about 80 acres of Atlantic temperate rainforest in a relatively healthy condition, a very ancient rainforest. And so when I was going through my own personal difficulties, at the same time that I was also returning to the farm with my wife and trying to figure out how one lives on a small upland hill farm and makes a living and raises a family in that environment, the forest was hugely healing for me. And the more I was beginning to try and understand how to live on the land, and I realized that the prevailing advice from all of the farm advisors and agricultural consultants was, if you have a farm and it has a big chunk of ancient woodland on it and you want to make a living, then where possible, try and cut that woodland down so that you can maximize your grazing potential and the amount of livestock you can put on that land, predominantly sheep. And it didn't seem to sit right with me. And it really set my wife Lizzie and me off on a mission to not only try and learn about the habitat, but also learn about how we might help other farmers and other landowners and land stewards to see how they could view rainforest management and rainforest restoration as not only a more ecologically worthy thing to do on land that they were stewarding, but also a more financially viable activity as well, which has really been the work of our charity, the Thousand Year Trust.
So how does this actually work then? Because it would seem, on the face of it, as you say, from the advice you were getting at the time, that would seem the way you're going to maximise your money from the land there. How does it actually work by doing the exact opposite and actually increasing the temperate rainforest area?
In exactly the same way that in places in tropical rainforest nations like Brazil at the moment, subsistence farmers are being encouraged to go into pristine rainforest environments and hack them back to make very poor grazing land for species like cattle, a completely non-native species to South America. For the last 2,000 years, farmers have been increasingly encouraged to cut down trees where possible, hack back rainforest and ancient woodland in order to make more and more grazing land for livestock across the UK. And we've been doing this for cattle and horses and pigs, but also for non-native varieties like sheep, which is predominantly a desert import to these islands. And what that has meant is, because we've been doing this for several thousand years longer than they've been doing it in South America, whilst they've cut down 50% of the world's tropical rainforests, we've cut down about 99% of our Atlantic temperate rainforest, which is a huge ecological tragedy. Now, when you then look at the economics and also the food security issues around sheep farming, when I was beginning to get into this world in 2017, you'll remember it was after we'd voted to leave the European Union here in the UK, but we hadn't actually left at that point. And many upland hill farmers, I found an NFU report that showed that many upland hill farmers across Bodmin Moor and Dartmoor were taking as much as 85 to 92% of their annual income from European subsidies. So sheep farming in the uplands is a very heavily subsidized activity. It really doesn't make much in the way of a living, and you'll struggle to find a sheep farmer who's rolling in money. Most of my neighbors and before we transitioned away from farming, us too were advised by the British Wool Board to either burn or bury our wool every year because it just holds no value. At the moment, you can sell a fleece for about 25p and it costs £1.30 to shear a sheep. So there isn't much money in the wool. And then in the meat itself, we export about 40% of our lamb. And we use 22% of the UK's farmland for sheep farming. It provides less than 1% of our calories. So as a pillar of our food security, that also doesn't hold up. So this land is currently being managed in a way which is financially unviable and also isn't a part of our food security policy. So when we then look at some of our very, very important elements of our sort of our national strategy around carbon sequestration, climate mitigation, biodiversity uplift, and also creating beautiful places for humans to spend time, because we all need these wild and natural spaces, and we need the ecosystem services they provide, from flood prevention, drought prevention, clean water, clean soil, clean air. Very little does that as effectively as something like Atlantic temperate rainforest, especially in these upland western areas where the land has been so degraded over many centuries.
Everything that Merlin says makes total sense, and I think that's why I was captured by his book, and that's why we were keen to bring him over. And we have, although the numbers are slightly different, in fact, we actually export more lamb, I think, in the Isle of Man, the same problems exist. And Manx Wildlife Trust has a good relationship working with farmers through the Agri-Environment Scheme. And we need to support our farmers, we need to support our food production to turn this around. And I think what really struck me in Merlin's book was some of the other stuff that the temperate rainforest that he's restoring there is doing in terms of its healing properties. So Merlin brings ex-military, ex-service people to his site at Cabilla and give them the opportunity to really enjoy the restorative effects of being in nature. And that, for me, is a wonderful thing. And I think with the work that we're doing here in the Isle of Man through Manx Wildlife Trust and the Aviva supported temperate rainforest restoration work, is we're creating places that bring huge benefits for both mental and physical well-being on the island.
I'm always worried that I come in and it sounds like I'm criticizing farmers on the uplands. I also want to come in and just make it really clear that nobody works harder than farmers in these upland areas. And I feel very lucky here that coming from a farming family and living within this farming community, and we now have a cluster upon Bodmin Moor of upland hill farmers, 18 of us, over about 7,500 acres, who are all working to restore this habitat and to also restore peatland and to integrate conservation grazing schemes. No one works harder than these farmers, and they will do whatever society and government policy encourages them to do. And if it's farm sheep, then they're absolutely right to farm sheep, because that is their role and their job. I just hope that we can create a system where farmers see it as not only a more financially and ecologically viable, but also something that they can be proud to do, where they restore rainforests. And we're seeing that increasingly, which is wonderful to behold.
And I think that's one of the reasons I really wanted to bring Merlin over, because he comes from a farming background, and so he understands the issues. And I really hope that we'll get lots of farmers coming along to this talk to join in the conversation and work out together a way forward that helps both people and nature thrive on the island.
Me too.
And so I can think again, people maybe listening to this, perhaps not within conservation spheres, but are interested in it, but will be thinking, what exactly makes then a temperate rainforest? Because not, as you say, we've lost a huge proportion of it, but not all sort of woodland or forests on the west coast of the British Isles, I assume, are classed as temperate rainforest. Or are they? What specifies specifically to make something into a temperate or Celtic rainforest?
Graham, I'm happy to take that one, or do you want to?
Do you want to go first?
I wouldn't want to step on the toes of Manx Wildlife Trust. And it's a really great question, because we have so many beautiful habitats in the UK, and there are really important habitats all over the great span of the British Isles. Temperate rainforest is the one that I'm personally passionate about, and I have that great fortune to be able to be one-track minded and single habitat focused. And it tends to have existed down our Western Celtic spine, everywhere from Stornoway on the Isle of Lewis, down the Western Highlands past Fort William and Oban, down through places like Cumbria and the Lake District, the Isle of Man, then that Western belt of Wales from Anglesey to Aberystwyth down to Pembrokeshire, and then in the southwest, places like Exmoor, Dartmoor, Bodmin Moor, the Lizard and West Penwith. And it's defined, of course, by the amount of rain that it receives. And we are lucky to receive a lot off the Atlantic in our Western Celtic fringes. So you need at least 1400 millimeters of rain a year. And that rain can't all fall in one big monsoon season or one big cloud dump in December. you need to have a little bit every month of the year. And the reason for that is because it feeds the epiphytes, which are so important to rainforest habitats. And epiphytes are any plants that don't use the soil to grow. So the kind of things you find up in the canopy, things like lichens, mosses, polypody ferns, liverworts, pennyworts, bryophytes. And these things thrive on oak trees, which tend to be our paramount species within our temperate rainforest. And a single oak tree can hold up to 600 species living in it at any one time. So these rainforests become very layered and very complex and busy spaces. And that's one of the things that makes them quite so beautiful. And the subject of so much of our folklore and our childhood stories, these are the habitats where Geoffrey of Monmouth's Arthurian legends were set, where Tolkien's Fangorn Forest was based, where the Jabberwocky and the Mabinogion were set. So they are very much a part of our identity and our culture.
As you say, there is a wonderfully folkloric feel about it. If you go into any of these, again, the Celtic rainforests over here, and they do have a, yeah, I should have used the word magical, but there is a sort of feeling of that. There is a definite sort of feeling of calm and a very restful place to walk. Is it a challenge with something like the thousand-year trust you're working with now, that we live in a time scale where everything is instant gratification and short-termism, or something like this? We're talking, as you say, 1,000 years. We could be looking generations into the future. Is it part of it trying to get people to alter their mindset with this?
Absolutely. And I think that's so important. And there are a number of reasons why I called the charity the 1,000-year trust, but one of them is absolutely to try and draw people away from this short-termism that we've been trapped within, where everything is judged based on 2 or 5 year timelines, and actually try and encourage people to suspend that human time bracket and think a little bit more like an oak tree for a second. These are 1,000-year creatures, and we're being constantly bombarded with doom and gloom about climate change and biodiversity loss, as we should be, because all these things really are happening. But there is a source of optimism within the heart of it, because when we're asking questions like, can we reverse climate change by 2030, we absolutely can't. These are large and long-term issues which have a big lag effect, and we're going to have to really knuckle down and focus in on a long-term vision. Can we fix climate change by the year 3020? Absolutely we can. None of us will be there to see it, but that's much more beautiful to be involved in a multi-generational long-term restoration effort. And that, I believe, is a source of optimism and hope to fight the pessimism and climate anxiety that we're seeing so much of at the moment.
I would echo that completely. The contract that we have with the Wildlife Trust and Aviva for the temperate rainforest restoration, the contracts run to 75, 100 years. And if you go to the places where we've already planted 8,000 trees, like Craigie Cowan, all you see is plastic tree tubes with, saplings coming out of the top. And we won't be around in 50, 100 years when those places really start to look like a temperate rainforest again. But you can go there now and you can see the small amount of trees that remain, and they are covered, as Merlin says, with bryophytes. I think, I can't remember who coined the phrase, but my favourite phrase that really describes temperate rainforest is plants growing on plants growing on plants. So those polypody ferns, those mosses, those lichens growing on trees like oak and birch, etc. And you can see that in pockets in the Isle of Man, like the National Glens, Glen May, Elphin Glen, and you can see them, as I say, in pockets of trees in the areas of land that we've bought to restore temperate rainforest. I just wish I could be here in 100 years time when that's jumped out of those small pockets into the much wider areas that have been planted with trees.
So just going forward, I was thinking, you mentioned farmers there, and not wishing to decry the great work they do in uplands and around the British Isles, and of course here on the Isle of Man as well. Going forward, do you think we have to alter the way we think about farming and land management, or is it a case of the two coexisting side by side?
I mean, I believe that the two have always coexisted side by side, and often when we have this, I believe we have an issue around shifting baseline syndrome, especially around cultural identity. So often when farmers believe that they are farming in the way that land has always been farmed, and when any of us talk about doing something in the way it's always been done, what we tend to mean is the way our grandparents did it, or maybe our great-grandparents. So we're looking at a farming model across the British Isles, which is really a hangover from the Dig for Victory campaigns of the Second World War, and then the Common Agricultural Policy that the European Union put in place, where the focus really was upon farmers producing as much food as possible from an area of land, with often little thought for the environmental and ecological impact that that work would do. And that's not the fault of the farmers, because if that's what the government was encouraging them to do, then absolutely that's what they should be doing. We're now moving into an era where ecosystem services and natural restoration are being viewed of equal importance to food production, as it should be. And as we do this, farmers will begin to change their habits, because that's what they've always done. And there will, of course, be moments of tension and friction points. And I believe that the job of all of our organizations, especially the Wildlife Trust and my own small charity, is to help to smooth those frictions and help farmers to sometimes make that transition to more nature positive and nature friendly farming techniques.
And then just talking specifically about your own project, as you're saying, the 1,000-year project and replanting the rainforest in the Cabala Valley and trying to get it up to, I think, from 100 up to 300 acres again. Is the idea then for this to be a sort of template, as it were, for other people to see the sort of how you can go about this work?
Completely. That's exactly what it is. So we are a small site and we're a blueprint site. So we have tripled the size of this rainforest. We've re-established 100,000 trees across the valley. We've brought in species that have been missing, like beavers. We're now working with the local Wildlife Trust down here to bring back missing mesopredator species like wildcats and pine martens, which are vital to rainforest health. But we're also implementing a carbon capture scheme, a biodiversity net gain scheme, an ecotourism project, and leveraging off the new sustainable farming incentives and ecosystem service grants, so that we can demonstrate to other small-scale and mid-scale upland hill farmers that this will not only help them to restore landscapes, but it will help them to have a more financially resilient business model that keeps their families on the land, because that's the most important thing. So the idea, the mission of our charity, is to catalyze the movement that triples the amount of temperate rainforest growing across the whole of the UK. We don't aspire to do this by buying any land. We aspire to do this by creating a blueprint, performing the research, and then working with the wonderful organizations like the Wildlife Trust, the National Trust, the Woodland Trust, but also groups of small and medium sized and large size farmers to make this change. And that's why we're working with a cluster of 18 farmers across Bodmin Moor to do this across 7,500 acres, because that demonstrates real landscape change.
I just love everything that Merlin says, and what really comes out of it is collaboration. It's about the conservationists, the scientists working with farmers for the benefit of people and nature, which, you know, who wouldn't support that? So I'm really pleased that Merlin's going to be able to make it over Thursday, 23rd of October at Peel Centenary Centre at 7:30 p.m. We've already sold half the tickets, so if you're interested in getting there soon, details are on our website, mwt.im.
I can't wait to come. Thank you so much for the invitation, and I really hope I'll have the chance while I'm out there to see some of the Manx rainforest as well.
Wild thing.